From the Amazon basin, from the magnificent redwoods of California to the icy majesty of the Arctic, life on Earth faces an unprecedented threat from careless development. Join Terra Verde over lunch today to find out about the unfolding future of the planet.
Welcome to Terra Verde, a weekly environmental radio show on KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley, or KFCF in Fresno. My name is Carolo Aparicio, and I'll be your host on today's show. Given mounting evidence that global warming really is happening, and that the impacts of a warming planet will have far-reaching implications, there are some people who are already talking about adaptations to life on a planet with higher sea levels and extreme weather patterns. How will people adapt? And who is responsible for footing the bill for these adaptations? To talk about this issue, joining me in the studio is Dana Dilworth, co-founder of Citizens League for Environmental Action Now, Clean, and organizer of a conference called Global Warming, Toxins at Bay. And I'm also joined by Michael Warburton, executive director of the Public Trust Alliance. Welcome to Terra Verde.
Thank you.
Hello.
So the topic that you're, Dana, the topic that you're addressing at the conference on global warming, Toxics at Bay, has to do with toxic dumps along the San Francisco Bay in the face of global warming and rising sea levels. What was the inspiration behind looking at toxic dumps and global warming?
I have been the chairperson for a community advisory group in Brisbane, and we have about 600 acres of very toxic soils, and was concerned when I didn't think the public was aware of the kinds of changes and choices they were going to make in what they will call a cleanup, but essentially is leave many of the toxins in place. And am concerned, based on personal history of having had an experience with storm surges and hydrology living in a home along a shoreline in New England, and know that in addition to the waters that might be rising from the sea or falling from the sky, that those waters get into the groundwater. And had a couple of discussions. One was with a person named G. Fred Lee, who said that this technique of trying to keep these toxins isolated and dry won't work if there's groundwater or springs that pass through it, because it creates movement in the toxins. I'm also kind of frustrated that I think that wetlands aren't being given they're due as a potential solution to, one, producing oxygen as part of the mix that we need to consider in global warming, but also the fact that as the waters rise, these plants and animals that are dependent on our wetlands will no longer exist if we don't create the environment to anticipate their need. And I had learned that in a workshop that was put on by the Nature in the City, and had heard Joshua Collins from the San Francisco Estuary Institute speak. And I realized that when I'm doing the work that I need to in my community, I'll reach out to other people and they will say, well, I know about this, but I don't know about toxins, or I know about toxins, but I don't know about wetlands, or something to that nature. And I feel that the time is of the essence to bring people together to get a more global look to this issue. The format is to it'll be a day-long symposium, which
actually,
we'll mention later.
Just to get an idea, I'm sorry to cut you off, but just to give people a little bit of an idea as to where some of these toxic dumps are located around the bay, where are these?
Well, in Brisbane, it's the old San Francisco dump and the old rail yard that is between the border of San Francisco and the lagoon in Brisbane, and then 101 in Bayshore, in which actually straddles three cities: Daly City, Brisbane, and San Francisco. And I am familiar with the communities that are dealing with base closures in Alameda, people from Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition dealing with similar things down at Moffett Field, and communities in Richmond dealing with the Zeneca sites and some of the Bayshore line issues as well.
Well, what would be the effects of these dumps being submerged underwater? What would happen if that scenario were to take place?
It's my belief that the waters will, the whole groundwater level will rise. And in doing so, and what we've observed in our area, is that it creates an artesian effect, which pushes the water up to the surface. And that is... becomes an avenue to push the migration of the toxins along, too.
So I can imagine that there would be all sorts of really bad health implications associated with all these toxins being pushed up by artesian processes.
Correct. Health implications to the people and beings that could breathe things that become volatilized and get carried off in air or gas form. People who come into contact with it, but I'm also concerned about the toxins that get into the food chain, that get into the mollusks, that get into the birds, that then get into the fish, and that cycle. And so we will have these toxins moving at greater speed, and like I had said, this could be actually Mother Nature doing her job, could be the Great Flush. But then again, we have chemicals that we don't know about their synergy when they mix with each other. And they break down sometimes into components that are more toxic than the ones that they started from. And there's a whole... one needs to put that into the mix if we're going to be making decisions to wall off cities and things like that, because that groundwater will then have to be handled somehow.
So the conference that you're organizing, by the way, it's Saturday, June 9th from 9 to 4. Oh, I'm sorry. June 2nd from 9 to 4 p.m. at Golden Gate University Lecture Hall, and we'll provide more detailed information as to how to get there. Could you tell us a little bit about the panel, the panelists? What sort of experts have you attracted to speak to this issue?
Well, I've broken it into three kind of components. One, the first portion of the day from 9 to noon would be focused on the water rise, the protection of the wetlands, and the public trust implications, or the fact that we as a body need to make consideration of these resources, which are in the public's interest. We will provide lunch, and I know it's difficult to say this, but I am booking food for 75 people. And then after lunch, we have a portion called Remediation 101, where we'll have a panel of three remediation experts that have worked both with federal Superfund sites and municipal waste and military issues. And I have asked that panel to be allow as much question and answer as possible, because in my position in providing information to my community, I am often needing to have some technical assistance in this area. And I really want this to be open, as open as possible, to answer questions to the public. And the final portion, about 2:30 to the end of the day, is about affecting change. I'm calling it 1-2-3 action. And it's based on something an attorney named Sharon Duggins once said, is that to affect change, you can do it one of three ways. You can do it legislatively, legally, or grassroots. And the legislative way is to work with your senators and representatives and your council people. Legally is to know the benchmarks of to know when you can and can't respond legally. There are different windows of opportunity, and oftentimes lawsuits bring people to resolution on these issues. And then finally would be grassroots, which I have invited people who have done miraculous things in the area of protecting the public. And one person in particular is Bradley Angel, who we may all know that, in my opinion, almost single-handedly, but within an entire community, stopped the Ward Valley relocation of radiated materials.
Wow, that sounds like a really interesting program that you have planned. Now, Michael, you're going to be a panelist in this conference. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and your interests and how you came to this work?
Well, first off, the idea of, you know, what to do about these toxic dumps under conditions of climate change is the tip of a much larger iceberg. How did these dangerous chemicals get there in the first place? And just like the carbon emissions that are playing a role in changing the atmosphere, we just keep using these same toxic processes and consuming the products. And the idea is that this is a waste problem that we treat at the end of a basically unquestionable good process. And my background's actually been in taking a look at larger issues and seeing where problems come from upstream. And I've been the executive director of a group called the Public Trust Alliance, which is a project of the Resource Renewal Institute in San Francisco. And in many ways, problems are sometimes yours or mine or ours. And yours or mine is what law usually settles out. But ours is a problem of what is the public doing as a body. And in many ways, you know, this climate change and reacting to it, we can either discover our collective humanity and work together on these things, or we can parcel out a disaster to, you know, to the most vulnerable communities in our society. And things are looking like, the business as usual basically parcels things out to vulnerable communities.
Now, I want to come back to that issue, but unfortunately we have to do a station break right now. This is Carolo Aparicio, and you're tuned to Terra Verde, a weekly environmental show on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno. I'm in conversation right now with Dana Dilworth and Michael Warburton. So I'm sorry to have cut off your train of thought there, but can you tell us a little bit more about this issue of the public and the, I guess, privatization of disaster and parceling out catastrophe to more vulnerable populations?
Well, I guess I should go back to what the whole notion of the public trust doctrine is. It's a law that's been in our society for, well, it started in old Roman and Greek times when The Justinian, it was an emperor who codified it in 500 A.D. It's basically the following are common to all mankind, the air and the running water and the sea, and consequently the shores of the sea, so no one shall be prohibited from approaching the seashore. And it was a notion of public access to public resources. And in our laws today, there are some things that are just too important to be treated like private property, and water is one of those things. Instead of it being owned, it's held in public trust for all members of the community. And sort of working with this law, we found various ways of bringing people together to solve very, very difficult problems.
So can we talk about some of these solutions that that might be in the works, solutions as adaptations for climate change? What have you seen in other countries, maybe?
Well, there's some surprises. As you have coastal erosion happening, and whole acres and acres of farm fields are falling off in parts of England. We had a situation in Louisiana where we lost a major population center, and it didn't look like very much was being done in the way of adaptation. The response of our institutions was basically to build better walls and levees, and the thing that we've got to realize is that those levees will fail. And in California, there's a lot of real estate development that's taking place on waterfront properties. And instead of taking a look and seeing that these waterfront properties are vulnerable, there's almost like a mad rush to develop them, and so that the public will have to build walls around them to protect them. And in our delta, we're building below sea level in an absolutely insane manner. And that looks to be what's going to happen around the bay. But you can see which communities probably will be able to build walls and which communities won't. And the consequences will be suffered by those communities that won't.
Well, tell me a little bit about the communities that won't be able to build up some of these defenses. Which ones are they?
Well, I don't see, well, for example, like in the South Bay, Alviso, being able to develop a huge public works project to develop a levee.
Why is that?
They don't have a big enough budget. Mm. And what's happening is, in many cases, city governments are depending on either the state or the federal government to come to their rescue, and there just is not enough money to do that. Now, there are some developments, you know, where wealthy individuals and families or corporations are able to direct public resources to protect their investments, but it doesn't happen at other areas. Mm-hmm. So
Dana, returning to the topic of toxic dumps and, mm-hmm. and rising sea levels and climate change, what are some of the alternatives that have been proposed to addressing this?
Well,
let's talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Well, I was going to say, I hope that this is the material that comes out in the symposium, and that, you know, I have examples of things called resource mining, which I have been told they do in Finland, where they go back into old landfills and they pull the recyclable materials out of them. Now, I know some of these areas are just too big and too close to public to do that, but I have seen them say to leave pockets of lead in place, and there's a technique where you basically put electric poles into the earth and get all the metals to line up and charge to the north or south pole. And so with just really simple little things that we can do, like set up the zone between a north and a south pole on a stick, whatever, that could be a solution to getting a pocket of lead out of the soil. I am a fond believer of the use of wetlands for breaking down quite a few toxins. I don't know if they can be as efficient as I would hope they could be. And so this is the kind of conversation that I hope comes out of this summit, so that if wetlands aren't the solution, then what do we do to make sure that we protect that resource, the wetlands, and the nursery part of a whole ecosystem, of a cycle of life. And so if I had the answers, you'd be certain that I would be listing them, but this is intended to be a community conversation.
Okay, so what I was hearing was a plan for removal of toxins, like some of the heavy metals, and regeneration of wetlands as being mm-hmm. integral parts of this plan. But really, what seems to be going on right now? What seems to be the plan of the authorities? Who's in charge anyway? There's a pregnant silence when I ask who's in charge anyway. Indeed, who is in charge, would be in charge of a process like this?
There are public agencies, or they're called responsible agencies, and dealing with water issues and dealing with them on the state level, it would be our regional water board. There are other responsible agencies that do speak or do work with the public.
There's also agencies which are legal trustees for the public, who have affirmative responsibilities to take action, and sometimes precautionary action, to keep resources available for healthy public use. And the State Water Board is one of those. They are a trustee for the people of California. And that's what the Public Trust Alliance does, is very often there are meetings where testimony is taken, and the trustee agencies very seldom identify themselves as trustees. And the public, members of the public, come up and ask, maybe you could do something important here because we're getting hurt. But in legal terms, with public trust resources like water, the water belongs to the people. It's our water. So we can ask some of these agencies to do a better job of doing their legal job in protecting our resources. And I know that you were interested in the precautionary principle earlier on. That's a ability of a public agency or regulator to actually take action before there is absolutely clear scientific proof of a condition. And in many of these toxic waste situations, there is more than adequate proof that they're carcinogenic, and something has to be done. And then the public agency says, well, we can't do anything because there's no legal link that obligates us to do that. But the public trust does. And for example, the Supreme Court of Hawaii made a judgment that traditional resource trustees have, they said that the precautionary principle is inherently part of traditional trust duties of these agencies. And an important part of getting the Hawaii Supreme Court to that decision was what happened at California's Mono Lake. So it may actually be part of our laws right now.
Now, a little while ago, you mentioned some of these agencies that are responsible. What are some of these agencies, and how can people engage them?
Well, I wanted to say something that, based on what Michael said about connectivity, because my experience has been that there's has been fragmentation. There's fragmentation by land ownership. There's fragmentation by responsible agency. There's fragmentation by one's water, one's toxic, that kind of thing. And The reason I worked to put a community advisory board together was to bring all these people together. And because when I did public records requests, I discovered decisions were being made that the public was unaware of. And hopefully that's what this summit will do. We'll bring people together. We'll let people know that there are resources out there, that there are issues that we need to resolve. And if the outcome of this is that our laws aren't adequate, because oftentimes I hear from these state regulators, there's no more I can do. This is the extent of the law that serves their department. And to me, if that ends up being a barrier, then we need to get beyond that and work as cohesively as a group.
Okay, that's great. One of the things that I want to get to is, could you tell people once again where this conference is going to be and how people can get more information?
Okay, it's Saturday, June 2nd, 9 to 4 p.m. at Golden Gate University, which is roughly First and Mission in San Francisco. It'll be at Lecture Hall 2203, which is second floor. And that's 536 Mission Street, and pretty much an all-day thing, but people can also come for portions of it.
And how can people get more information to contact you?
I have an email address, which is earthhelp, E-A-R-T-H-H-E-L-P, at earthlink.net. And I can forward information and ignore my spam blocker.
Okay, so once again, that's the conference Global Warming Toxics at Bay, Saturday, June 2nd, 9 to 4 p.m., and it's free at Golden Gate University, Lecture Hall 2203 in San Francisco. And that's all the time that we have for today's show. Thank you very much, Dana Dilworth of Citizens League for Environmental Action Now, and to Michael Warburton, the Executive Director of the Public Trust Alliance, for joining us. And thank you very much, Erica Bridgman, for being our engineer. This show and others are available at www.kpfa.org for your convenience. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. Oh, hi,